In 1992, a man, a history professor actually, by the name of Eugene Genovese, who had been for many, many years an ardent Marxist, politically left-leaning professor, began to question what he had seen on that political spectrum. And he asked his colleagues a question. And he was asking the question because he was beginning to see all the totalitarian and leftist regimes around the world and the fact that they constantly begot violence and destroyed their people and, you know, completely controlled their lives in such a way that he felt like there was something wrong, something endemic in the thinking of that particular political spectrum. Anyway, he asked the question, what did you know and when did you know it? You know, were you willing to admit what these regimes were doing? Well, my lesson today is not about politics, but it is, I'm kind of taking that same question, and I'm going to ask it of Jesus. What did he know, and when did he know it? Specifically, about himself. You know, it's one of those mysterious things that God could become a little child. And I don't have an answer to how that took place, other than to know that somehow God did this mysterious thing of becoming a human being, becoming a baby. And, you know, as Janet and I were enjoying our grandson over the holidays, certainly he's just a wonderful little child. It's a human being, no doubt about it. And he gibbers, you know, and he walks around and he laughs and he smiles and he cries, he gets cranky. And, you know, but he's a little child. How can God become a little child? I don't have an answer to that. What I see here is a slice of his childhood. And I'm really not sure why this story is important. Luke is the only one who puts it in here. It could be that this story is important for no other reason than to demonstrate early on that Jesus was in fact aware of his very special nature and his mission. That's the only, well, there's several other reasons perhaps, but what I'd like to do this morning is I'd like for you to put yourself in the story in a couple of different ways, okay? You know, it's obvious stories are told from a point of view, and there are other characters within the story who have a particular point of view. We don't always get theirs, but we kind of assume what their point of view might have been. And sometimes I think it makes the story more real for us to say, all right, let's sit in there somewhere. So we're going to do that this morning. We're going to sit in the story from a couple of different points of view and try to see if we can maybe understand a little bit more. There are actually four different points of view here. One of them is called the omniscient point of view. That's the one we're getting. All right, that's the way the story is told. We're looking down and just watching everything. We know the beginning and we know the end at this point. We know how it's all going to turn out. Okay, so that's kind of us reading it. There's the point of view of his parents, who are a little perplexed and certainly worried about their son. There's the point of view of his teachers as well. We don't get much from them. We have to assume a couple of things, but I think we can still look at it from their point of view. And then, of course, there's Jesus' point of view, what he says to his parents and what he's doing and why he is where he is. So let's take a look at those. First of all, we'll take the omniscient point of view. That's sort of an English term that we use to talk about what is a particular type of point of view. We're looking, omniscient means all-knowing. We look at the story, we already know the whole story. This is only the beginning of the story, but we know the beginning, middle, and end. We know how it's going to come out. We're looking at everything, okay? And that's also Luke's point of view. He's writing it down to kind of give these stories to the next generation of Christians so they'll remember them and know exactly what they are. It's how he narrates the story. And, you know, Luke is actually presenting to us, is he not, the account of the witnesses that he's interviewed. If you go back in Luke chapter 1 and verse 2, Luke says, Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us. It seemed good to me, et cetera, et cetera. So he has gone back and he's talked to the people who've seen everything. and who knew everything. Now, he had to talk to Mary to find this one out, we suspect, or certainly someone who knew Mary very closely to get this particular story. And in a literary sense, again, he's using the omniscient point of view. We know all these things, but here they are. And we see all that happens knowing the outcome of the story. Now, he's the only gospel writer who provides this particular episode. And I don't know whether that's terribly significant, but I see this as kind of as much as a human interstory as it is a theological story. It's just kind of, I don't know if I want to say heartwarming, but it certainly is indicative of what happens in families. Okay? Now, I think there's clearly a theological point that he's trying to make, but, you know, we see Mary and Joseph and Israel's teacher struggling to comprehend Jesus. That's really what's going on here, isn't it? They're perplexed in one way or another. And so it's interesting to see how people react to Jesus early on. I'm not so sure it's all that different even when he gets older. There are some other things that happen that make it even perhaps a little bit harder for them to accept him. But the fact is, we see them all reacting to him. You know, I'm not so sure the reactions are all that different from what people do today when they encounter Jesus and they see who he was and what he did. And yet we are given this very strong theological insight into Jesus. Knowing what we know and looking back on the story, perhaps we're not as perplexed, us reading it, as those who first experienced the young Jesus. You know, if nothing else, this story for us kind of affirms what we believe to be true. And that is, Jesus was somebody different. He was a very special person. We believe that because we know later on all the things that were said about him. He was the Son of God. He was God in the flesh. He came among us. He died. And he washed away our sins. That's the whole theological impact of who Jesus was. Here we see people kind of struggling with who this guy is early on. But it affirms for us just what we do, in fact, know about him. How about his parents in this story? And I'm kind of suspecting maybe some relatives as well. You know, it says in the story that he was traveling with a group because his parents thought he was with the group somewhere when they left Jerusalem. All right. Now, I'm not sure why they would assume such a thing, to be honest with you. Maybe it was just one of those things that when you're traveling with a group, that everybody's expecting everybody else to kind of watch out for the other's kids. Yeah, maybe that's all it was, you know, and maybe it was a common practice that when the kids all travel together, they might, you know, spend some time with kids from the other family and they might, you know, but I mean, to me, you know, when you're leaving, you at least have to know, okay, he's with so-and-so. They just assumed he was with them. Now, you know, maybe that's first century social life and family life. I'm not so sure I would assume that. But they began searching for him, it says in verses 44 and 45. I kind of wonder if that was around dinner time. You know, okay, we assume he's with everybody, but at some point during the day, we'll just catch up with him, or he'll catch up with us, or, you know, we'll know where he is. I'm making some assumptions here. But you see, at 12 years old, Jesus is on the verge of manhood in the Jewish sense of being responsible to the law. I don't know if they had something called a bar mitzvah back then, but that's kind of the idea. Today, perhaps, we are surprised to find that 12-year-olds were often apprenticed and sent to work in earlier times. I don't know back in the first century, but certainly later on, back in the early 1800s, British boys were sent off to be apprenticed as seamen at 12 years old. Okay, and by the time they were 19 and 20, if they hadn't been made an officer by then, their career was pretty much over as far as a naval, you know, as far as any kind of naval career. 12 years old, they went to sea. And they were under the tutelage of those who were on the boat. You know, so it sounds strange to us, but that's what they would have expected. Would his parents, and I'm just going to ask a lot of questions here to think about what their point of view was. Would his parents have thought he was ready to make his way in the world at 12? I don't think I would be comfortable sending my kids off at 12 years old. Okay, you're out of the house now. Go, man. You know, today it's for us legally, it's 18. Now, I don't know why we chose that age, but I don't know that it's just entirely arbitrary, but we feel like we have to educate them a little bit more, okay? They get worried, naturally, though, don't they? When they find out he's not with the group. And as the day, after they go back, the day turns into 3 days. What do you think they're feeling by now? Probably panic. How much sleep do you think they got during their search? Were they praying the entire time? Did they involve the authorities in some way? What is it? I think legally now the police can't do anything unless a person is missing for, is it 48 hours? I think that's it. You know, and it's like they are bound by law, you know, in a way, not to do anything. Now, I don't know what the authorities would have done back then or who they would have gone to. How was it that after 3 days they went to the temple? Were they the authorities that they were, you know, supposed to get to help? But for some reason or another, they go to the temple. And maybe they were there praying and just happened to notice that he was there. I don't know. We're not really told all that information. But when they go to the temple, it says in verse 48, and when his parents saw him, they were astonished. Now, I kind of look at that word as being a little bit more than just they were surprised. All right? There's a whole range of emotions going on inside of them right now, aren't there? They've lost their son, their 12-year-old boy, for 3 days. And finally to see him, I'm guessing there's a little bit more to this astonishment than just surprise. There's probably a lot of relief. It's probably mixed with a little bit of anger that he was there and he didn't try to, you know, contact him or something. To his mother, I get the impression this gets a little personal. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." Basically, she says that, look, we've been worried sick about you. And I have to believe that kind of hidden here, there is a sense of relief. But she just, it kind of all comes out here, doesn't it? His mother is pretty upset. She has been worried sick. She lost her son for 3 days. And I don't know that Jerusalem was all that safe of a place. It could have been. But my guess is there was violence. There were things that a 12-year-old boy could get into and get hurt. Somebody, you know, there were evil people in the world. She just wants an explanation. Did you think to let us know where you were? Why didn't you call? You know, why didn't you call? We loved it when our kids, if they were going to be late, just call. Just let us know. Okay, so we know you're okay. We know nothing's happened, etc. Obviously, he couldn't call, but here it was 3 days, and his parents were worried sick about him. But then, of course, we have the point of view of the teachers in the story. Now, there's not a whole lot that we're told about how they're thinking, but let's just assume a couple of things. They may have been asking because they're astonished at his wisdom and at his answers. I wonder if they're saying, well, who is this child prodigy? You know, child prodigies are exceptional, aren't they? Think Da Vinci, Shakespeare, Mozart, okay? Wise or at least talented way beyond their years. Where did they get that from? Who taught them that? How have they been endowed with this particular wisdom and abilities that the rest of us don't seem to have? Well, what other things might they have thought as they were talking to him? Were they filled with a sense of wonder? I mean, you know, we know when we, you know, sometimes just sitting and talking with little kids is just, it's just kind of like, you know, the things they say. What was that show by Art Linkletter? Kids Say the Darndest Things. They just come out with stuff and you go, where did they get that from? Yeah, well, here's a 12-year-old boy and they're going, where did he get that from? even more so perhaps in the kind of things he would say. Were they skeptical of his answers? We don't know. Were they jealous of his prodigious mind? You know, rumors surrounded Mozart's death. When Mozart died, there was, I don't know when they started, but somewhere along the line, somebody had rumored that maybe his teacher had poisoned him out of jealousy. The fact is, probably what happened to Mozart was he died of a very serious form of pneumonia, and that caused your organs to stop functioning. It's the same pneumonia that killed Jim Henson of the Muppeteers many, many years ago. He got pneumonia, and it was the kind of pneumonia that, I guess it was, I don't know if it was bacterial, but it was the kind of pneumonia that it just affected your whole system, and your organs stopped functioning. It looks like you may have been poisoned, you know, but that probably was what killed Mozart. Now, when Jesus grew up, he began to challenge those same leaders frequently. This is still early on, and he hasn't challenged any of them yet. They asked, for example, who is this that can forgive sins in chapter 5, verse 21. In chapter 11 and verse 15, they said he has a demon. And in chapter 15 and verse 1, they said, what's he doing? He's receiving sinners. And in John 7 and verse 15, I think is the most interesting one, because I think it's still prevalent today that people ask this kind of question. In John 7 and verse 15 says, the Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it this man has learning when he has never studied? See, Jesus doesn't have all the right credentials. He doesn't have all the letters at the end of his name. And how's he get all that? Who's he to tell us? We're educated. And so later on, you know, they begin to ask these questions. At 12, though, he's not yet a threat to them. He's only a kid. I kind of have to wonder how many of them may have remembered this and talked about it, perhaps. His insights and questions at such a young age certainly were a source of wonder. And, you know, were some of these guys still alive later on when Jesus starts his ministry and said, I wonder if this is the same kid that we talked to back such and such. What, 18 years prior? He was 30 when he started his ministry. He's 12 here. 18 years later, suddenly this guy shows up and it's like, who is that? Now, it's interesting that the people talk and they spread rumors and they do remember things. You know, from John's birth to the angels seen by shepherds to this event at the temple, these events no doubt created quite a stir, even if only among a select few. People talked. You sit down at your dinner table and you talk. Well, how about Jesus' point of view? That's, you know, it's a marvel, isn't it, to see this young Jesus. His answer to his parents seems a bit cryptic, or at least to them it's sort of mysterious, isn't it? First of all, he asks, why were you looking for me? Well, the answer to that question is, because we were worried sick. That's why we were looking for you. But I don't think that's quite what Jesus has in mind. He seems unaffected by his parents' worry. Or at least he doesn't express that he's, gee, I'm really sorry. He says, well, you know, why were you looking for me? There seems no indication of remorse here. At least at first look. That's the way I see it. That's what the answer sounds like to me. And then he asks the question, how come you didn't know where to find me? Answer, well, how could we know that? You know, how could we know that? How are we supposed to put together that you were born in a very special way? Huh, wait a minute. Maybe we should have known that. You know, that we knew that God, and Joseph in particular, he knows that God had given him dream after dream after dream after dream very early on in his life, you know, to go to Bethlehem, to run away from Bethlehem, to go to Egypt, and to come back, and then to go to Nazareth. He had all these dreams. You know what? Maybe Mary and Joseph should have known that something was going on here that was connected to God, and that the temple was the most natural place. I don't know. Their thought probably is, well, how could we know that? I think it's more likely that Jesus' answers here come from genuine surprise rather than reproach or being very flippant. I think he really is surprised that his parents maybe hadn't put two and two together yet. To him, you see, it seems entirely natural to be, as quote, in his father's house, about his father's business, engaged in what his life is going to be all about. And already, it seems like he knows this. He's aware of it. There seems no question here that he's aware of it very early on. At what age does he become aware of it? Our little grandson is 15 months and he gibbers. You can't understand a word he's saying. Some suggest that they know what they're saying. I don't know how they know that. But the fact is, he's saying something. At what point is he really aware of the world around him in a way that we think he ought to be? I don't know. But the fact is, by the time he's 12, Jesus knows something about what his life is all about and who he is. That he is going to be about his father's business. And the reason I think he's not being flippant or being, his questions are not just reproachful, but rather surprised, because he goes home and is submissive to them. And perhaps this is the climax of this particular episode. And, you know, maybe Luke wants us to know about this episode. Maybe there's been some rumors about Jesus' early life, and Luke wants to set the record straight. That Jesus was really a pretty good kid. That he didn't do anything. And that this episode was just an episode where he just went to his father's house because it was the most natural thing for them. It tells us that this was not his habit of him to disobey his parents. And it does indeed prepare us to see him later. If in fact we've never encountered the whole story. But here we see Jesus early on and then we see him later. And all it says here is he grows up. He grows up. And by the time he's 30 later on, chapter 3 becomes, there's a long break basically between chapter 2 and chapter 3. Which is not uncommon in the biblical narratives at all. It says that Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Jesus grew, this is very interesting, he grew in the same way that Samuel also grew in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 26. The language is almost the same. He just grew and he got wiser and he grew and he got bigger. And he had favor with other people. He worked well with the community. Perhaps there were stories about Jesus' early life, and Luke wants to set the record straight. I've already mentioned that. Jesus was probably, he was not a rebellious youth. Could there have been some rumors about that among the church? Certainly among people who were detractors of the faith? I would say there very well could have been. People were spreading a lot of lies about him. They did that all the way through his ministry. Luke is just simply saying, look, here's a story about who Jesus was. He wants us to know that Jesus possessed a very deep self-awareness of who he was and what the purpose of his life was. From his birth to his early years to his ministry, death, and resurrection, there were events constantly demonstrating just how extraordinary Jesus was. We are called upon to remember those stories for ourselves, to set our own life's course by them. Jesus was about his Father's business. We too are called to be about his Father's and our Father's business. When his point of view becomes ours, we're all the more blessed and guided because of it. And this story is all the more reason for us to believe and continue to be faithful to him today. Eric, let's stand and sing.